Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
What's up, DC? Maryland, Virginia. It's Danny and Pete. Pete and Danny, whatever way you slice it. Danny Rouillet. Pete Metters with you. Tommy, and Tommy's back in studio. I thought there was going to be an update. And I said, I've got a minute and a half. I'll go ahead and take a bite of this sandwich. And boy, was there no update. And I didn't have time to take a bite of the sandwich. Tommy down the line gives the dreaded "You're Up" with the theme music playing. And I got about 20 bites to go. That's just kind of the adventure that you run here when we can't see each other face to face. We don't have things timed out. I've only been doing this 10 years, Pete. You'd think at some point I would learn when it's safe to take a bite of a sandwich and when it's not. I make this mistake in studio back in the day. Remember in the time before time when we were in studio sometimes? I would make this mistake all the time during commercial breaks. I'm still making it at home. 10 years in, I still don't know what I'm doing. Pete, what's up, buddy?
And, of course, in those situations, the bearded boy wonder can look right at you and still see you chewing, and he can pick up the slack at that point. And, obviously, at this point, Danny, the question begs, what is the sandwich? What is the quality that caused you to have to get every morsel and every bite down before you greeted the fans here on a Sunday afternoon?
This is the sad life that we're leading now for a guy that, if he has a carbohydrate, turns into the Michelin man. I've got this Thin Slim Foods is the name of the company. I order a bread.
What are you eating?
Thank you very much, Tom. So we got Thin Slim Foods. They deliver bread. It's for all the replacement stuff I found, you know, like trying to live this low-carb lifestyle.
Sure.
The fake noodles, like the, where they go, let's just have some squash noodles or zucchini noodles. Those can die in a horrible fire. They're terrible. I hate them so much. They're the worst. They're awful. They suck, et cetera, et cetera. But for these stuff, and then it's got like a little bit of carb, but it's mostly like sub 6 or 7, depending on you know, kind of what the unit is. So I order bread from there. I get like my dessert fix from there. I order like a couple $100 worth of stuff every couple weeks. So it's a terrible habit to have. So I've got some sopressata, I've got some roast beef, and I've got some brie cheese, all from Wegmans, who has been great for delivering to the old Hooray household. So that is what's on my sando. Very pedestrian because the fake bread. I'll probably say this is a 50. This is a 50 sandwich with some salt and pepper peanuts, which maybe pushes to a 55. But it's passable. It's one of those things where you're not going to lose because of this guy, but you're not winning because of this guy either.
Well, in typical Pedro fashion, I have a glass of ice-cold Coca-Cola. It's the real thing. And also, these wonderfully made oatmeal peanut butter homemade cookies made by my mother-in-law, Shirley Joyce, who set down oatmeal raisin, oatmeal peanut butter, and oatmeal chocolate chip cookies yesterday.
That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. That's just so much fun. So delicious. Well, anyway, welcome to the show. We got you for the next 2 hours, 56 minutes, and change. Excited to be here. Happy to be part of the team. You've heard from all the other guys on the station kind of mixing and matching, and it's kind of a fun thing that we're doing here as the world has gone crazy and nobody's going into the office. So if you're checking us out, we appreciate that. You can tweet us throughout the show at Pete Medhurst, at Funny Danny for me. I've been basically killing time, Pete, with, you know, between getting the kids up and down and trying to do homework and stuff like that and putting them to bed. But I've been doing a bunch of stuff on YouTube, these nightly 30-second videos. 30 seconds or less is kind of the idea. I do, you know, an impression or two or something like that and just, you know, trying to have a little fun with that. So you can check that out, YouTube.com. Danny Rouillet 97 is my YouTube channel. There's a big playlist and stuff right there. What have you been doing at night to kind of entertain yourself and pass the time?
Well, at night, it's been pretty easy. I mean, I've basically been throwing in a YouTube video from days gone by. And on the side, obviously, I do a college football podcast. And my partner, Joe Miller, and I, who does the Navy games with me, our off-season project this year, instead, you know, obviously, you know, you do recruiting, things of that nature when that was part of it. But, you know, we went with a different idea for our off-season podcast. We chose a specific year. And this year, we're reviewing 1987. So we're doing doing a week by week, you know, week one, week two, whatever. And we got last night to the what was the pseudo national championship game. It came in week five or week six, depending on how you look at the calendar. It was Miami. It was Florida State. Mm. And Danny, it was 48 guys in that game. Of course, Deion Sanders was playing for Florida State. Miami had a plethora of people that would eventually end up in the NFL. But
so the number was 48 guys that were going to play on Sundays?
48 guys that played in that game. And of all the painful losses Florida State had to Miami during that period from about 87 to 92, where wide right, wide left, you name it, they lost the game. This was by far, in my opinion, the most painful because this was the one time in all those games where Florida State kicked Miami's ass. I mean, they dominated up and down the field. They were up 19-3 late third quarter. Miami was 1 of 8 on third down. Steve Walsh completes a circle out of the backfield pass to Melvin Broughton, who it was a great call by Miami because Broughton had been basically staying in pass protection the entire game, and they circle him out of the backfield, and you could see the defensive back basically soil his drawers, and he saw Broughton circle out and go right down the middle of the field for a pass route. Walsh, for one of the few times the entire game, and he was awful in this game, he hit him right in stride. Broughton scores a touchdown late third quarter. Danny, it changed the complete complexion of the game because Miami had no life at that point. It gave them life, and in the fourth quarter they would eventually come back based on Steve Walsh and Michael Irvin. Michael Irvin, say what you want about him being a Cowboy and all that other stuff as you're a Redskin fan examining it. You go back and look at production as a college wide receiver. Michael Irvin was as good as it was, and he made two humongous plays in this game with Steve Walsh. Miami rallies from 19-3 down. They eventually win 26-25. Florida State scores a late touchdown to get within one. Bobby Bowden, who all week long said he would go play for the tie so he could keep, you know, national championship hopes alive, be undefeated, yada, yada. By the way, Miami and Florida State, both independents at that time.
Is that right?
Yes, two of 24 teams that were still independent in college football. And then Bobby Bowden, they called timeout. So he changed his mind. He decides to go for two. Miami then calls a timeout. So they got all this time to think about it. They called maybe the worst two-point play in the history of mankind. They tried to throw a very poorly executed lob to Pat Carter in the back corner of the end zone.
We'll go with a fade.
Yeah. Bubba McDowell, the future Houston Oiler. Maybe Jay Gruden would have approved of the play call. But,
good play call, man.
You know, Bubba McDowell, the future Houston Oiler, and Selwyn Brown in the back of the end zone. Two guys between Danny McManus, who looked 40 years old. He looked like Nick Nolte in North Dallas 40, through just a terrible fade. And Florida State lost 26-25. So that was the game that we recapped. So I watched that last night.
That's fun.
And it was just, if you like football, if you really like football, it's worth it because Brent Musburger and Pat Hayden are worth the price of admission. When Brent goes off script, it's great in these games. And, you know, we know him for obviously, and many people will remember thinking he was the great host of the NFL Today. But, man, back in the day, it was great. Jim Nantz was the studio guy at that time. So it was really interesting to go back and watch that game in full and just to see all of the talent that was on the field for both sides.
That's something, dude. I mean, and that's kind of what I think a lot of sports fans are doing to get their fix is, you know, I watched the other, just because I'm just constantly on, like, I'm Zoom chatting with my pals or, like, on email lists. We're sharing, like, our favorite songs to listen to right now and a bunch of different things. And it's all, you know, we're just killing time and finding ways to try to stay in touch. But one of my buddies, you know, out in, he's in New Mexico, actually, is, you know, obviously massive DC sports fan. He's just there, you know, trying to chop wood in the desert as an attorney. And he goes, I just happened to be watching Game 5 on YouTube. Game 5 of the NLDS, right? For no other reason than knowing that the outcome is great. It's not just another DC sports thing. And so we ended up doing that together. So he's watching. A bunch of guys go, oh, I'm free. I'll do that too. So we're gathered around on our computers live. We synced it up like a Parker Lewis can't lose, synchronized watches. And we're sitting there texting back and forth while watching Game 5 again. And we were reminded how probably 80% of that game was awful. 80% of that game, maybe more, 85, 90% of that game, you just felt like there was no chance. There was no way. Walker Buehler was unhittable. The Nats weren't going to score on him if they had 100 innings to do so. He was making them look foolish. He was nasty. The first couple batters of the game, Dodgers are up. They had a run in the second inning, and you're going, oh, my God, this is – What, you know, what better scenario for you? The best postseason pitcher the Nats could possibly offer in Steven Strasburg, a superstar, their guy, their horse, the dude that saved their bacon against the Brewers. This is the stud. This is the guy you'd want on the mound. Getting hit around early on. They can't hit. Oh, my God, it's happening again. Another gut-wrenching, horrible loss. And then, obviously, everything changes with those two batters, Rendon and Soto going back-to-back. And you still thought, even, I mean, in the ninth inning, when their catcher, I think it's Will Smith, hits that ball off Hudson, you're going, that's it. Dodgers just walked them off. Dodgers just walked them off with one out. Even if it's not a homer, it's going to be off the wall or run's going to score. That's going to be the ball game. Settles into Adam Eaton's glove just in front of the fence, et cetera, et cetera. You know how it would end. But even with bases drunk, nobody out there, Pete, in the 10th inning before Kendrick hits that grand slam, Joe Kelly was nasty the inning before.
Yeah.
Striking everybody out with that filthy slider and everything. And so I understand why Dave Roberts sort of left him in there and left him the twist of the wind. But even thought with nobody out, bases loaded, the worst thing's going to happen. This is going to be the broken bat double play where they go home to first and they wiggle out of it, et cetera. I've seen this before with the Nationals. And Howie Kendrick, on a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, just below the knees on the inside corner, hits at about 425 feet to right center field. People don't understand that's not possible. Human beings shouldn't be able to do that, and he does it. But we're all watching this together and celebrating like we saw it for the first time. But I think that's what people are doing. They're just finding stuff to do and you know, look, you know, dusting off classic-type things. I mean, I'm watching Evgeny Kuznetsov send the Yinzers home the other night, you know, in that overtime situation. You look at some of the classic sports, and you're kind of doing the deep dive like you're talking about.
Yeah, no doubt. Did the same thing. And that game five, almost reminds you of the wild card game in some cases, because for, you know, seven or eight innings, you're sitting there going, oh, man, it's been a great season. But unfortunately, it's going to end right here. And yet, just like they did in that game, they found some heroics, again, from Howie Kendrick in that contest. But even before they got to that point, just to get the game even against Clayton Kershaw. So just amazing.
Oh, just an amazing run. And again, they it's an elimination game, so of course they're trailing in the seventh inning or later. And of course they won it, because that's what that group did. And we missed the chance to celebrate that this past week here with our home openers getting banged due to this weird situation. We're just getting started here. 106.7 The Fan. It's Pete and Danny. Here's what I want to do next with you, Pete, if you're game. The 2020 NBA Hall of Fame class is announced. Obviously, a special thing having Kobe Bryant do it. You don't have to wait the requisite period because of what happened in the tragedy. And it's a nice moment, I think, for the family and so many Laker fans and NBA fans and Kobe Bryant, etc. But I want to put some of the emotion and feelings aside here. Who's the best player in this pretty standout class? Kobe Bryant. You got Kevin Garnett in there, and Tim Duncan, the big fundamental. I want to have that debate with you. Let's do that next here. Just getting going on The Fan. Hall of Fame announcement from the NBA. Pedro, welcome back. It's Danny Ruggier, Pete Medhurst, hanging out with you. I guess it was yesterday where the class is announced. And congrats to all the inductees. It's a pretty exceptional class. Headlined for me by three incredible in-my-lifetime NBA players. That's how you know you're old, Pete. Right, is all the guys that you saw their entire career getting put in the Hall of Fame. You know what I mean? Like when you remember their first game and you remember what they did in college or lack thereof in the case of Kevin Garnett and Kobe Bryant, would you remember everything about them? And you saw their whole career and now they're in the Hall of Fame. That's when you know it's over for you. The first time you're in your car and you go, wait a minute, that's not classic rock on the classic rock station, you're old. But so your headliners in the class, Kobe Bryant, obviously, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, and slightly down, even though this was a great player in his own right and a wonderful coach, and Rudy Tomjanovich gets himself elected, and Eddie Sutton, Tamika Catchings, Kim Mulkey, Barbara Stevens, a Division II Coach of the Year, and a FIBA executive named Patrick Baumann, who I know nothing about. I'm sure Pedro does, but I don't. So to me, I want to basically go with this top three, Pete, in the class, Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett. Let's make a case for each one. And I'd love to invite you guys phone calls on this as well. 800-636-1067. Who's the best player in this class? Okay, who's the best player in this class? Let's make a case for each before we kind of make our decision. You want to go first?
I'll go first.
Go for it.
Look, I think...
Start wherever you want.
What's unique about all three of these guys, Danny, so different in all the respective ways that they dominated the game, that they earned this Hall of Fame nod coming up here. Obviously, Kobe, as gifted a scorer as we've seen in the game, but, you know, not one of these Alex English-like you know, scores, where a guy just scores a lot of points because he plays on a team that plays no defense and shoots a lot of shots. Obviously, the guy's a five-time NBA champion. A guy obviously made a huge effort on the other end of the floor. There were times in his career where he had to, you know, share the spotlight, certainly with Shaquille O'Neal. And then there were times at the end of his career with the Lakers where he was kind of like the only guy on the team and had to show some leadership in terms of that. I think when you look at the combination of being able to score the basketball and obviously, and I think a lot of people, you know, when they just think about Kobe on the surface, Danny, they appreciate all of the ways that he scored the ball. This guy was a 12-time All-NBA defensive player. And I think because of the combination of both and the fact that he played championship-level basketball five different occasions, 18-time All-Star, 15 times All-NBA, as we, you know, like we do in football, we want to, you know, discern between All-Star and All-Pro. Well, in that case, Kobe was All-NBA 15 times during the course of his career. So four-time All-Star Game MVP, MVP of the league. So from that standpoint, because of the combination of both offense and defense, I will give the nod to Kobe. And I don't know, to me, I don't know how much the difference is between him and Tim Duncan, because Tim Duncan, completely different role, but a guy that did both, you know, for the San Antonio Spurs. But I would say Kobe has to get the nod in this situation just because of the all-around play and the hardware.
So I'll make the case for Kobe here before we make the case for each of these guys. You want to tell me who you think the best player in this class is? I just posted a poll at Funny Danny on Twitter between the three guys. I imagine Garnett might get the short end of the stick here, so I'll advocate him for him in a second. But in terms of Bryant, you're right. The score, the inside and out, the versatility on offense, if he's just an offensive player, excuse me, very coughing. He's just an offensive player. He's a one-way player. You're talking about a guy that in that era was as gifted a scorer as anybody. Other guys would lead the league in scoring throughout his career, but in terms of what defenses were forced to do to account for him, lethal from the mid-range, kind of worked on that with Olajuwon in terms of the post game. You saw him develop that as his career went on. Going to the basket, especially early, just how wonderfully, aggressively he was able to attack the rim. A streaky, but I would say plus outside shooter as well. Off the dribble, in rhythm, coming off screens, a complete offensive player. Add into that how excellent he was on defense at times. I thought his rep sometimes, Pete, outsized maybe his actual performance on the defensive end. But once he broke through and got himself an All-NBA, I believe NBA first team in terms of defense, he actually had one more than Tim Duncan in his career. He showed you that he could do it in those moments, right? He's not guarding, you know, Tracy McGrady or, you know, the other team's best player for 48 minutes. But when it was needed, when it was important, he's locking guys up as good as anybody in history of the game, kind of, you know, anyone from one playing one through three on the opposition. An excellent, excellent player, an all-time player, obviously belongs in the Hall of Fame. That's not up for debate. But and you also look at some of the impact off the court. I mean, that's the guy. I mean, when Team USA goes to Beijing, right, that's the celebrity. That's the superstar. That's the guy that everybody's clamoring around to see, screaming his name. And, you know, Kobe Bryant, again, taken from us way, 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 way too soon. But sort of taking emotion out of this, who was the best player? Let me stump for a minute for Kevin Garnett here. And I think ultimately I'm going to go Tim Duncan. But let me stump for Garnett here, Pete. Garnett is a guy that I believe if he was 6 inches shorter would still have been in the NBA. Now, he may not have had the career that he had, but in terms of what he could do, a Swiss Army knife, he ended up later on in his career being more of just a, you know, a post player and rebounder and, you know, playing some defense, sacrificing, doing what was needed the first time in Boston. But you watch some of his prime when he was in Minnesota, when he was in that 24 through, I would say, 27, 28, 29 range. This is a guy that they ran their offense through. This was the point forward. This guy was doing what Scottie Pippen did at 6'6 or 6'7, but he's 7 feet tall doing it. Averaging nearly 14 rebounds a game, 5-6 assists at times per game, and an efficient shooter inside and out. Could do everything, could dominate on defense, averaging, you know, in right around two blocks per game for a lot of that time. He's getting steals like he's a guard. everything that guy did on the court for some pretty good Minnesota teams, I might add. Not great. They can never overcome some of the big boys, right? But I think they made a conference final once, if memory serves, when he was in Minnesota. This was a superstar. And if he had a good supporting cast, we'd talk about him in a different light. This would be one of those Pantheon power forwards. This would be in the Malone, Barkley, Tim Duncan range. And I don't think he ever got enough credit for as great a player and an efficient player as he was.
From age 22 to age 30, Danny, there was few players that dominated the game the way Kevin Garnett did. And you mentioned, I think, a good point. He did this at times with very little quality supporting cast in Minnesota. And obviously, part of the argument there is, okay, well, if he's the man, he's got the ball in his hands most of the time. It's easier said than done. This is a guy that still shot because he was the focal point of what was going on. Danny, he still shot fairly close, if not above 50% from the field, each of those campaigns when the help wasn't there. But from age 22 to age 30, Danny, he was a double-double machine. He averaged 20 points and at least 10 rebounds every single one of those seasons, most notably 2003-2004 and then 2004-05. I mean, the guy's at 24-2 and 13-9 rebounds, 22.2 and 13.5 rebounds. I mean, that's just, I don't care whether you're playing in a Western Conference where, you know, offense and a lot more shots seemingly were going up. Those are ridiculous numbers. And he's shooting over 50% from the field in both of those years. So there's no garbage there. There's no, as again, I come back, I love to use the old analogy about the Denver Nuggets. I mean, there's no garbage here when it comes to Kevin Garnett. These are well-earned numbers in these situations. And this is a guy, Danny, that at the foul line, most big men, we see a lot of guys struggling out there. This is a dude that shot, you know, upper 70s to over 80%.
Right, 80%.
Seasons in the NBA. The complete package in many respects. And I think, Danny, if he's playing in a different franchise than Minnesota from age 19 to age 30, if he's on one of the more marquee teams, I think we're talking about Kevin Garnett in an even higher profile than we do right now. I really believe the fact that he was loyal and stayed with that franchise as long as he did. But I truly believe if he was on one of the more higher-profile franchises, we're talking about a much higher-profile even Kevin Garnett right now upon his Hall of Fame nomination yesterday.
Yeah. Multiple 50-plus win seasons at a time where the Lakers were a buzzsaw, the Trailblazers were excellent. We know about the Kings in those points with you know, Flip Saunders as the head coach or Kevin McHale in one of those years, as you kind of referenced. But the next best couple of players on the team are an older Sam Cassell, good player, Latrell Sprewell, good player. That's just not on par with what other guys had. The championship contenders had more each and every time. So you look at some of the guys that we think of as, you know, the first bananas or the superstars. What's Kobe Bryant done without Shaq? They had two titles where it was he and Pau Gasol. Those are more impressive to me than when you have, you know, the most dominant player in the league in Shaquille O'Neal. I consider those three Shaquille O'Neal titles as opposed to Kobe Bryant titles, for example. If you gave Kevin Garnett a similar caliber supporting cast to some of those elite teams that are going to the finals on an annual basis, again, I think we think of him in a different light. Let's carry this over here, Pete, because I want to get to Tim Duncan next, because he's overlooked because there's no flashes of emotion, there's no shoe deal, there's nothing exciting about his game. It's just clinical leaning on you. But that's the way I always think of it. That's how I describe it. It's just what he's doing to people down in the post in an era that's now bygone, where he's just leaning on you and leaning on you and leaning on you, breaking you by attrition, a complete player, a team player, a star that didn't behave like a star. I want to stump for Tim Duncan here next, and we'll get your calls as well. 800-636-1067. The poll is simple. Hall of Fame class gets announced. Your headliners, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Durant. I keep saying Kevin Durant. Oh, my God. Why did I keep doing this?
He'll be there one day, Danny.
He's going to be there. I'll try it again. Kevin Garnett, Tim Duncan, Kobe Bryant. Who's the best player out of the three? Pete and Danny here on The Fan. Pete and Danny here on The Fan. A little hoops topic for you on this Sunday at 12:31 Eastern Standard Time. You're listening to us. Give us a shout, 800-636-1067. You don't feel like calling, that's fine. That's your prerogative, Bobby Brown. You could tweet me at FunnyDanny, Pete at Pete Medhurst. Pete, top of your head, I'm putting you on the spot here. Who is seventh all time in win shares in the NBA? I'll give you some other guys in the top 10 to sort of help jog this. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain, LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Karl Malone, John Stockton, Those are some of the names that surround this one guy who's seventh all-time in NBA history in win shares.
Well, Danny, since we're doing a show and we put out a poll about three guys, I'm going to guess that it's the guy that we have not touched on yet, and that would be the young fellow, the former great swimmer from the U.S. Virgin Islands turned basketball player. That would be one Tim Duncan.
That's Tim Duncan. And here is what's so beautiful about that. Kobe Bryant, by the way, who we've already stumped for, and we're taking turns here, going back and forth on, you know, kind of the case for each guy. Kobe Bryant is 19th all-time in win shares. He trails Reggie Miller, trails David Robinson, Charles Barkley, Chris Paul, Julius Erving. Now, this is just one stat, okay? And we're talking about, I've already stumped for Kobe Bryant, but now we're talking about best of the best, elite kind of stuff, right? Tim Duncan, 7th. Kevin Garnett, by the way, 9th. So here's what this tells you. Tim Duncan was not as good a scorer as was Kobe Bryant. You know, stunner, news at 11, right? There's nothing crazy about saying that. In terms of being an all-around impactful basketball player, when you look at low turnover rates, when you look at the amount of offensive touches, the offense running through this player, you look at the rebounding, you look at defense, everything that you can do on a basketball court well, Tim Duncan did well, except for shoot threes, and at times he was streaky from the foul line. Ended up a sub-70% guy, even though he had years north of 80%, Pete. Remember that one year, I want to say it was like in 2011 or 12, somewhere around there, all of a sudden got right from the foul line and was shooting 80-plus percent. But for the most part, later on in his career, was in the 70s in terms of free throw percentage. So negative there, and then not really impactful as a three-point shooter. Barely attempted about 0.1 per game over the course of his career. But everything else you can do on a basketball court, Tim Duncan did and did well. Everything from screening, everything from guarding the other team's best inside player when that was a major, major part of the game. It sounds funny to talk about post-play at this stage, right? Because that's dead. That's gone. Nobody does it. Everybody puts five guys outside the three-point line, drives or shoots a three, and if they're driving, they're looking to kick it to someone else to shoot a three. But that's the game now. The game wasn't that way then. When he came into the league in the late 90s, San Antonio Spurs, he and David Robinson, and this is where I stumped for Tim Duncan over someone like Kobe Bryant. In general, you know, if you listen to my normal show, the Grant and Danny program, we don't do the did he win the game though kind of stuff, right, in team sports. Basketball, to me, I don't want to say is the exception to that, but it's as close as you'll find to an exception. One player who plays 80 or 90% of a game can impact both sides of the football. No quarterback is making tackles for a team, for example. No major league pitcher, especially in the American League, is doing, you know, things for his offense. So wins and losses, it's more to me about how you play. In the NBA, one player can have a profound impact. Tim Duncan was the best player on 5 championship teams. Kobe Bryant was the best player on 2 championship teams, part of the same conference, playing at the exact same time. That matters to me, Pete. Now, there's some variables within supporting cast, and you look at another Hall of Famer in Robinson towards the end of his career. Early on, it's guys like Sean Elliott, Avery Johnson. Later, of course, it's Timmy Parker, and also great playing with Manu is very great. But you look at those two guys, great players in their own right, but doesn't necessarily compare to what Kobe Bryant had at times in terms of supporting cast. So to me, Tim Duncan deserves the nod as the complete player, and he's my answer among these three guys who's number one. If I've got to rank them, it's Duncan 1, Kobe 2, and I feel like we're shafting Kevin Garnett here, but Kevin Garnett 3, even though I think if he was on a different team at a different time, we'd be considering him one of the all-time greats. He's already going to the Hall of Fame, obviously, but I'm talking about that first-tier upper pantheon. But I got Tim Duncan in this because of the all-around game. Your thoughts?
Obviously, Danny, too, think about it this. We talk about Hall of Fame, especially the NFL now. We discern between Hall of Very Good and is this a guy that people really like, so we give him the nod for the Hall of Fame. These three candidacies right here, there's no debate. There is no debate about the candidacy of these three people here, first of all. To your point, and I can buy it, and here's why. And we, you know, a lot of times we bog down on whether a guy was a scoring champion and all this other stuff. Tim Duncan, the first, and you, I think to your point, and this is what backs up your point perfectly, both ends of the floor. First 10 years of his career, Danny, he averaged over 2 blocks a game. First 13 years of his career, he rebounded in double digits. Oh, by the way, willing passer as a big man. Several occasions, 3.5 assists or more. And in fact, in 1 year, in 2002-2003, he nearly averaged 4 assists per game. So the guy was not a black hole when it came to the ball. He was a guy that was exceptional at moving the ball within the team concept. As we know, that's the way the Spurs like to play. So not only do you get a guy that's averaging over 20 points a game for the first 9 years of his career and 9 of the first 10, but you're getting a guy that's scoring points, you're getting a guy that's preventing points, you're getting a guy that's facilitating offense for others, and he's obviously going to the glass and clearing almost 10 defensive rebounds a game. So not only is he giving you 3-plus offensive rebounds, which gets you more points, but he's limiting opportunities for the other team by blocking shots and his defensive rebounds, which on multiple occasions were nearly 10 per contest. So to your point, all of those facts, I think, make a legitimate case if you want to go with Tim Duncan in that situation. And the grand scheme of things, whatever, you know, as you mentioned, you know, win-loss record and all that other stuff, he also won the game, you know? He also won games and won championships with that Spurs team. The numbers are not arguable, quite frankly.
And so you look at some of the other things, we're getting out of the nitty-gritty. And again, I think you touched on it very well, Pete. These are all clear and obvious Hall of Famers. When we're knocking some of these guys, it's we're picking nits about some of the greatest ever, right? So when people got mad at me around, again, the time of Kobe's just unbelievable and unfortunate passing. Just still hard to stomach that was something else that happened in 2020 as we're sort of in this bizarre time. But when I've said in the past, I don't think he's even the best Laker of all time. And that sounds like it's a big insult. It's not, when you consider Kareem Abdul-Jabbar sitting right over there, when Magic Johnson is sitting right over there. I don't think it's an insult to say he's behind those guys. Again, sort of first ballot, pantheon, greats of the game, you know, perfect basketball players at a time when those things sort of didn't exist, right? So Bryant, to me, not even the greatest Laker ever. I don't hold that against him. I'm just simply saying that's sort of where I am. But it's so when I'm sitting there talking about how great Kobe Bryant was, they're going, wait a minute, you said this negative thing about it. I'm going, no. We're talking about one of the greats. I guess that's kind of my point to circle back to that. Within that sphere, within the obvious Hall of Fame, obvious let's celebrate his career, obvious cultural impact, we're trying to compare some of the who's the greatest among the greats, so to speak. You know, it's like who's the greatest Greek god? You know, is Poseidon better than Hera? I mean, that's kind of where we're at here. So for Duncan, finals MVP 3 times to 2, season MVP 2 to 1, more all defensive team selections 15 to 12 over Bryant. And, you know, rookie of the year when Kobe wasn't, but that's different circumstances. Tim Duncan, a longtime college player. Kobe comes in as a high school kid. So that's not necessarily a fair apples-to-apples comparison. But to me, overall team success, overall just, you know, the just sort of, I don't want to say impact because that's Kobe Bryant's category, but just to me, the all-around game of Tim Duncan. You look at some of the advanced stuff too. Remember when Michael Wilbon years ago, Pete, mentioned that that Kobe Bryant was the best closer in the game? Just sort of gave him this nomer. And that never made any sense to me. And like all the NBA guys couldn't wait to say that and repeat that sort of stuff. So somebody like brands something and everyone rushes in line to say it and make it part of their own lexicon. None of the numbers back that up. All of Kobe Bryant's bad numbers, turnovers, shooting percentage, you know, going down, all that stuff was exacerbated in the fourth quarters because it was just me ball. It was one-on-one time. Not the case for Tim Duncan. The exact same player in the first quarter as he is in the fourth quarter. And because he's not taking the fadeaway jumper with 1 second left on the shot clock a lot of times after dribbling for 15 seconds, we didn't give him the amount of credit that he deserved. They're playing the same team game in the fourth quarter as they do in the middle of the second quarter after Pop calls a timeout. I mean, that to me is part of the charm and why Duncan sometimes gets overlooked.
I mean, if you want to, you talk about closers and being able to hit shots. I mean, hell, you could almost put Gilbert Arenas there at one point in his career in the same category.
Sure.
Yeah, because just because a guy hits the last shot a couple of times in the course of a season or his career.
Yeah, Kobe did it a lot, yeah.
I mean, obviously they would both be in a similar category based on the opportunity of what. But I think what, to your point, Also, I think Duncan's numbers are even more magnified because he shared a front court with David Robinson early in his career. He yep. then shared shots with Tony Parker, with Manu Ginobili. So there was a constant ability of Duncan to play within whatever team concept Greg Popovich came up with, whether it was sharing the front court with another big man, or obviously once, you know, David moved on, Tim had the post essentially to himself, and then he became such a willing passer to facilitate the games of Parker and Ginobili with the Spurs.
Let's go to Will in Haymarket on line one. Conversation is this: best player, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, not Durant, Kevin Garnett, and Tim Duncan. Will, what's up, man? Good afternoon. You're on the Fan.
Okay, guys, thank you. Let me say, I've been listening probably for 10 years, so this is the first time I called. I had to. I think I'm the biggest Spurs fan in Northern Virginia. I was there from 97 to 03, so I saw two of Duncan's first two championships. Mm-hmm. You know, I got there when Robinson was hurt and all that, but it's not about me. So, Duncan, hands down, okay, look at who was on that 99 roster when they won. Sean Elliott, who was good, but he's not Scottie Pippen or Paul George or any you know, Anthony Davis, anybody's second guy right now.
Or Shaq.
thank you. Mario Elie. Will Perdue was on that team. Steve Kerr was there. He hit some shots. That was cool. But head-to-head against Garnett, since I lived there, I saw him every day, right? Okay, so every game, Garnett, and Garnett's great, but Garnett's hyped up, yelling, screaming, spitting, slapping his chest on every basket. Duncan comes down, just does an up-and-under, boom, runs up the court like nothing's up. Doesn't stare him down. Just runs back, and I'm pounding my chest for him. You know what I'm saying? It's hands down Duncan. But like you said, because of his attitude and his he was not me first. He didn't get that. Plus in the Western Conference and all of that. But then fast forward a few years. Okay, now we got Ginobili and Parker. They're good. But again, they're not Westbrook and Harden. You know what I mean?
Of course I get you, yeah. I mean, we're going to jump here. We're up against it, but I appreciate the phone call, Will. You want to chime in, 800-636-1067. Now, the only time you get that strike-shortened season, or lockout-shortened season, rather, in 99, where the Spurs win the championship. But, Pete, you want to talk about just steady Eddie. They're winning 60 games a year, pretty much. 57, 58, 57, 60, 58, 58. Through that, in Duncan's entire stretch, they're always in the conference semis or conference finals or winning the title just pretty much every other year from 03 through, I believe, 07. They win the title every other season and are always, always a threat to do so with Duncan as their best player. It's good calls on this, some good topic. Keep voting throughout the evening at Funny Danny on the Twitter poll. Coming up next, Pete brought a story to my attention. Pete, I'm going to let you take the lead on this one here. It's about a college athletic department and a program at kind of a crossroads. I want to let Pete take the lead on this one, something near and dear to his heart. We will do that here in a few moments on The Fan. Right now on MLB Network, I'm watching the 2015 Home Run Derby. Jock Peterson is just launching bombs in Cincinnati. But it's funny, Pete, I always like to check these things, and not because I'm excited about home run derbies or anything like that. I'm always underwhelmed by some of the coverage, and the TV tends to drag way too long. But I always like to look at who the all-stars are. Who are the guys that are watching? And it's a bunch of guys that are not all-stars or barely on rosters anymore in a bunch of cases. Like Adrian Gonzalez is one of the headliners here for the National League. So he's going to change teams, go to the Red Sox, have a great year or two, and then basically be out of baseball. Manny Machado is the guy that's trying to be caught. He's now an afterthought in San Diego after a very mediocre season. But stuff like that is always kind of fun. Now, there's Starlin Castro, for example, a guy that the Nats got for $1.15 and a pack of Wrigley's just now this offseason. But anyway, welcome back to the program. It's Danny and Pete here on 106.7 The Fan. Pete, I want to give you the floor here. You brought this story to my attention. And it's one of the, again, we have to offer all the caveats every time. We're a sports station. We're just doing sports shows here. In the grand scheme of things, this is small. This is a little deal. But that's kind of the stuff that we're dealing with. If you want the heavy stuff, there's plenty of programming for you out there. We're just kind of having a little bit of fun and bringing up some of the things you may not have thought about. But you brought a story to my attention about Old Dominion University. I want to give you a chance to kind of expound on that and tell folks what's going on.
Danny, I think this is an area where we're going with college athletics. I think there are some come-to-Jesus meetings between school presidents, athletic directors, conferences at the Division I level. And when and if we ever get back to sports, and I think those are legitimate questions right now, especially for the non-revenue sports. Danny, you played a non-revenue sport in college at a very high level. You know you experienced this. But wrestling is always one of those sports that is the first to go by the wayside when schools are having trouble eventually funding via Title IX requirements. So after 63 years, Old Dominion's wrestling program is going away. And when you really think about it, outside of feeding, putting a sling lid on them, wrestling is not what on the grand scheme of things, what you would consider a very expensive sport to put on. But when you start looking at the numbers that even these non-revenue sports, you know, you're talking $1 million here, $2 million for this sport. I really wonder what college athletics is going to look like and whether this is a precursor to a school like an Old Dominion either going the route of Liberty as an independent and making up its own schedule eventually, trying to find a better situation. Because I think Old Dominion bit off a lot more than they could really financially chew making the move from 1AA to 1A. Everybody wants to be in the 1A. We've got to be in the 1A. Got to be in the 1A. They've made a bowl game. We've seen them in postseason play in one of the minor bowls.
Their football team's been successful relative to that, right?
Right. I mean, they've had a couple of occasions where they did well with Taylor Heineke as the quarterback who eventually up on the roster with the Panthers and stuff like that. But they, you know, granted, even though they upset Virginia Tech, quote, a couple of years ago, they were still bad. They were a bad team. And they're a program right now that had to make a coaching change, and they're hoping that a Penn State assistant can bail them out. And I don't know if that's going to necessarily happen, because part of the problem for Old Dominion is they're in Conference USA, which makes no sense. I mean, they're going to El Paso, Texas. They're going to Houston, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I don't know about you, Danny, but if you've ever tried to travel to any of those places, it's not easy. And charter flights, you know, charter flights are expensive as it is, but you're trying to go to all these different places. I mean, this is not easy with a football team because you got so many guys. And I really wonder for, you know, schools that are like in the MAC, schools that are in Conference USA, the Sun Belt, I wonder where a lot of these athletic programs are going to be when we return. We saw the Ivy League this week tell, and obviously the Ivy League is huge, lacrosse, both men and women, but we saw the Ivy League tell those seniors who didn't get to play basically this year, played five games at most, tough. Sorry, you know, you're not getting a fifth year.
Yeah.
So I just wonder, Danny, where we're going at this point for some of these schools. The Power Five schools eventually are always going to be able to find a certain amount of money to keep going. But I wonder where we are going now, truthfully, for these schools that have hung on by a thread, because that money that the NCAA basketball tournament generates, over $600 million the NCAA normally sends out to all their schools. Well, this year, that money they're sending out is only $225 million.
Right.
That's going to be crippling. That's going to be crippling to a lot of athletic programs.
No, it certainly is, Pete. And there's a number of discussions here. And I know most folks aren't tuning into, you know, college baseball in the middle of the week. Maybe College World Series time on ESPN. That's always kind of fun from Rosenblatt Stadium in Omaha. But for the most part, people aren't watching regular season lacrosse games or, you know, but softball games or whatever. And I understand that. I get more our seat at the table. It's basically, college football, 1,000 feet of space, and then, you know, college basketball tourney time, which is a big money generator. But the point is, the college athletics is a lot of things to a lot of people. Right. And I think your point is very well seen. To me, you know, when I first get to, you know, playing college sports and I tried to explain my position that I was anti Title IX, you would have thought that I was the worst person on the planet. It's not that I'm against women's athletics at all. It's a very good spirit of the rule. And for folks who don't know, it basically says you look at the population of students on your campus and you've got to have a commensurate level or opportunity for women's athletics compared to your student population. So when you do kind of like your own internal census, if you've got 60% women and 40% men, let's say, you need to have 60% female sports options to 40% men sports options. And it's to encourage participation. And the rule is a wonderful thought. right? I'm all in favor of encouraging women's athletic participation. Anybody who's anti that's a crazy person. But the practice of the rule is what you're talking about. Men's wrestling is pretty much the first to go. And I remember at GW when I was there, we were in the middle of one of our Title IX reviews, and they said, hey, you guys need to have two more women's sports offerings. And so while I was there, they invented a lacrosse team. They're asking people, you know, on campus with flyers, did you ever play some lacrosse? Would you like a Division I scholarship? Show up to the field at 2 p.m. on Thursday and try out for this team. And so folks that had worked their entire lives, like, the gymnastics program, swimmers who had, you know, woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning to swim thousands of laps in the pool, or baseball players, basketball players who've gone through this incredible rigorous amounts of training, were now on the same platform as a girl that had no intention of playing college lacrosse, chose a school, and got a chance. Now, there's nothing wrong with that inherently, but when it comes at the expense of cutting a sport where there is demand, that's something that always never sat well with me. So I always wanted either that rule to be abandoned or modified in some way that says, I'm all in favor of finding a way to get ladies sports, but don't do it at the expense of this. And now with some of with lower dollar amounts cruising in for the next year plus, it seems like, Pete, I think that's going to happen a lot. I think people are going to have to really reexamine the role of college athletics on their campuses without that golden goose that is college football or this NCAA tournament.
No, I completely agree. And the thing about it is schools that are outside of the non-Power Five, and you might even include, you know, schools like Vanderbilt, who put a huge emphasis on academics. I think even the school that, you know, I work with, the Naval Academy, will always strive to be in that upper echelon. They don't want to run from that. They still have 30-plus thousand every week in their stadium. So it's not like the Naval Academy would be affected greatly by this. But it's like schools in the MAC where we watch these, you know, we get all excited for, you know, MAC action on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. But, Danny, we look up. There's six people in the stands. You know, there's nobody watching the games. So those schools are completely dependent on how much money the NCAA provides to them in these circumstances. And without that kind of funding, I don't know how those schools can promote not only their football, but, Danny, their entire athletic program, because of the travel, the equipping these players, feeding them. You know, everybody's got to have that training table now and things of that nature. So there's just so much that goes into this. The question's going to be, and obviously the Ivy Leagues have always kind of acted independent of themselves. They don't offer athletic scholarships as it is. Right. But someone, there's going to be a school president here over the next few months that's going to take the lead. And it may be a few of them. A few of them may come together on this. And we're going to have to figure out what to do with these schools that really can't, in many ways, support themselves for the most part and are completely dependent on that NCAA money, which this year is clearly not going to be anywhere near the normal amount that they usually get.
Couple things I want to do on the other side here. I got an NHL poll that Pete sent my way where a little disrespect to a local Washington Capitol. We'll talk about that. Also, just kind of get your opinion, just generally, reading the tea leaves. The president had a conversation with the commissioners of the major sports in the U.S. When are sports coming back? Want to get into that next hour. Pete and Danny here on The Fan.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.